It is the Taylor Report, 89.5 FM Toronto. And I believe we're joined by the author, Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Stephen, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much. I just told people, I'm going to tell them again, that you're going to be speaking in New York. We do have some New York listeners. And so on the 14th of this month, and that's Bastille Day, right?
That is definitely Bastille Day.
Steve Gowans is going to be speaking at the Solidarity Center at 7 p.m., 147 West 24th Street and the second floor. And it's the handsoffsyriacoalition.net that is organizing the meeting. And, of course, that's based on Stephen's report on his book, discussing his book, Washington's Long War on Syria. Stephen, you have an article that we want to ask you about, the sesquicentennial, and titled Humanity on Canada's Sesquicentennial, What Does Humanity Have to Look Forward to, Not What Canada Represents? We want to ask you about that. But first, since the Syria book has got a lot of attention, people, and I know you've been touring and talking, we have to ask you about latest news from the war in Syria. And I guess the big story is this one that is that perhaps Syria is, according to the Trump administration, thinking of using chemical weapons again. Not that they ever did in the first place, but that story, despite Trump's reputation, always seems to get traction. And it comes at a time when U.S. forces or their allies aren't really doing that well in Syria. Tell us what you make of this story.
Well, that story gets traction, but Seymour Hersh's story gets no traction at all. Seymour Hersh, of course,
yes.
The renowned investigative reporter who's recently written a piece to show that U.S. intelligence knew that there was no chemical attack at Khan Shaykhun. Which would be consistent with, you know, all of these allegations about chemical attacks by the Syrian government have absolutely no basis in reality. And if you look at some of the evidence that the United States government has offered, has adduced that these attacks have taken place. In fact, there's no evidence at all. Mm-hmm. If you actually read the documents that have been put forth, the documents amount to something like, and in fact, in one of the documents, I believe this word was actually used, this phrase, there's no smoking gun. But we believe that the Syrian government is responsible for a chemical weapons attack.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and by the way, this plays in very much to your book, because Washington's long war on Syria makes the argument that across the board and top to bottom, the all-powerful entities collaborate with each other to tell these stories. I mean, we just heard on Democracy Now! Bernie Sanders talking, you know, and everybody, so, and he is a popular figure. But he doesn't challenge this stuff. You mentioned Seymour Hersh. He couldn't get that published in the New York Times. He used to write for the New Yorker. They didn't want it. That's interesting.
No, he's been completely ostracized. But, you know, it seems to me it's incumbent upon us to exercise some degree of skepticism, and if someone's going to make an allegation, then it should be incumbent upon them to adduce the evidence. Well, they never do adduce any evidence. And then we have to ask questions like, what would it even make sense for the Syrian government to use chemical weapons? And, you know, some people have tried to address that argument by saying, well, they're using chemical weapons to intimidate people. Well, I mean, how are chemical weapons any more intimidating than a bomb? And, in fact, bombs are far more effective than chemical weapons. One of the reasons that militaries don't use chemical weapons probably has little to do with the prohibition or the convention that prohibits them, or the fact that militaries agreed to that prohibition is attributable to the fact that chemical weapons aren't particularly effective.
Yes. In the incident that they used, that Trump used, even in that, the numbers were nothing compared to the kinds of bombs that go off all over the place.
Yes. I mean, if the Syrian government wants to kill and intimidate civilians, then it can simply bomb them. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for them to use chemical weapons.
Yeah, Trump himself in Afghanistan dropped what he called the mother of all bombs. And it seemed to be like a tree that fell in the forest. I mean, nobody ever showed it had any significance, but it was one devil of a blast. It really appears just to be to keep the pot boiling, doesn't it? I mean, I noticed that Macron in France, he's a little talking different after his election, but he did have a conversation with Putin where, according to the press, he said, if chemical weapons are used again, France will react. I don't know what he thinks Putin's supposed to make of that. What's your assessment of that kind of rhetoric coming from Paris?
Well, I mean, this is a very handy pretext, isn't it? I mean, this is back to the old red line. Here's the red line we're going to draw, and if the Syrian government steps over the red line, well, that provides us with a rationale for direct military intervention. That's pretty convenient, because all you have to do is wait for someone to provide some kind of occasion to suggest that chemical weapons were used, and then you simply declare that you believe that they were used. You have no evidence. There's no smoking gun, but we believe that they used chemical weapons, and you can intervene.
It's a commentary, isn't it, on the American media that they're actually it's blood on the floor between the American media, so-called, and the Democrats and Mr. Trump about false news and him accusing them and them accusing him. But meanwhile, they all just they don't have a problem with the most shallow, dishonest exercise of all, this thing about chemical weapons. It doesn't speak very well about the Americans' commitment to any of the principles that they lay out. And I think that's a good segue for us to talk about your article about Canada. There's all kinds of claims made by London and Washington and Paris, I guess, and certainly Ottawa, that we represent very advanced ideas and we're really good people, as Justin Trudeau said in his speech, not to Albertans, but to everybody else. And that we have these advanced values. Your article on Canada's sesquicentennial, what does humanity have to look forward to, not what Canada represents? What does 150 years tell you about what Canada represents?
Yeah, and I should make a distinction between, well, I should say that Canadians have been led to believe by the people who foster mindless patriotism that our country stands for peace and democracy and human rights and freedom. And maybe most people in the country do embrace those values. We do embrace those values, but do our governments embrace those values? No, they don't. And I think the case against that is irrefutable. And you can cite a number of reasons why our governments are not reasons, but a lot of evidence that they don't embrace those values. But we could take something or a recent event, and that is, for example, the $15 billion arms deal to sell light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia, or the fact that Ottawa's hammered out what it calls a joint action plan with six Arab Gulf monarchies, including Saudi Arabia, which spells out how Canada is going to deepen its relationship with these countries in the coming years.
And by the way, that is without any asterisk or, you know, side remark like they tend to do when they talk about China or Russia, where they always say, of course, we're looking for an improvement or we expect an improvement or maybe we shouldn't even be doing this. They don't, when they talk to those Gulf states, they don't say that, do they?
No, and I mean, this plan sets out areas of cooperation between Canada and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain on everything from politics and security to trade and investment, energy, education, and healthcare. Now, why is that a problem? I mean, you know, governments and mainstream media like to demonize, say, North Korea as this dangerous, militaristic, belligerent dictatorship where there are no human rights and the leader eliminates his political enemies by using anti-aircraft barriers or batteries to gun them down. But Saudi Arabia is everything that North Korea is said to be but isn't, and worse. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a complete despotism. It's an absolute monarchy. There is no democracy. There are no human rights. There's certainly no human rights for women, who are essentially treated as chattel of men. The country's engaged in an unprovoked war on Yemen because they don't like the fact that their puppet in Yemen has been deposed, which has led to a virtual famine. No one says anything about this, but this is an absolute aggression, a war of aggression, a complete crime, which is being facilitated by the United States and Britain. Saudi Arabia is one of the chief financiers of the jihadist insurgency in Syria. And with a population less than that of Canada, has the fourth largest military budget in the world. I mean, greater than that of France, of Britain, of India, of Germany, and Japan. And we call North Korea a militaristic, belligerent, dangerous dictatorship. And yet we embrace Saudi Arabia. We do deals with Saudi Arabia. We dote on them when their king dies. I mean, in Britain, they lowered the flag.
They lowered the flag.
Yeah, they lowered the flag. And, of course, the president, Obama, immediately went off to the funeral. And we do deals with them. We sell them $15 billion worth of military equipment. And why? I mean, we don't care about, or our governments don't care about peace, democracy, human rights, and freedom. What we care about, what governments in Canada stand for and have always stood for, is the pursuit of economic interests. And not the economic interests of Canadians as a whole, but the economic interests of this narrow spectrum of wealthy people whose money power allows them to exert considerable influence in Ottawa. Yeah. And in this respect, we're not different from the United States. Recently, Condoleezza Rice, who was Bush's national security advisor, and had said, written in her memoirs, or she was doing an interview with National Public Radio in the U.S., and written in her memoirs that U.S. foreign policy has nothing to do with promoting democracy and human rights. She said, it's all about, she said this, for every president, for every secretary of state, the principal concern is U.S. security and U.S. economic interest. That's what matters. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true in Canada as well. That's what matters to Canadian governments, not peace, democracy, human rights, and freedom, but making money and dealing with, you know, these despotisms which run roughshod over human rights and engage in unprovoked wars and finance jihadist insurgencies. And if we can make money off of that, then we're prepared to overlook any concerns about war, democracy, human rights, and freedom.
Yeah, if it was the People's Republic of Southern Arabia, they'd have to pay a lot more for that oil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even if, and they'd have to be very nice about it if they wanted to get some of that oil. By the way, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, you tell in this essay, and I really urge people to read it, because you include a very sober discussion of when Lyon Mackenzie King, Prime Minister King, and, of course, he was a World War II leader, and you say, well, and he fought the right war, but he fought it for the wrong reasons, and you talk about who he was in terms of his origins and his dealings with Mussolini, Hitler. Could you give us an outline of what you learned about him?
Well, King, like many people, many statesmen of the time, was an admirer of Hitler, and he also hated Jews. I mean, anti-Semitism wasn't restricted to Germany.
No, by the way, you document, you have he kept a diary, bless his heart, so we know he actually wrote these things in his diary, right?
Yes, he visited Hitler in Germany, and he was very taken by Hitler.
And his policy toward Jews.
Yeah, he wrote that, you know, I would have loathed living in Berlin with the Jews and the way they had increased their numbers and were taking possession of it in the most important way. And then he went on to say it was necessary to get them out, to have the German people really control their own capital and its affairs. Mm-hmm. Apparently King also was very concerned about Jews living in his neighborhood in Ottawa as well. He didn't like that very much. But he, like Churchill, for example, Churchill also admired Hitler and sang peons to Mussolini. Mm-hmm. And you know, these fascist dictators were admired not only by King and Churchill, but large parts of the British and North American establishment. And they were admired because they were anti-communist. Mm-hmm. Hitler was an anti-communist, Mussolini. I mean, that was the leitmotif of their political lives, was opposing communism. And that's why people like Churchill and Mackenzie King admired them.
Yeah. And apropos, you bring up the subject. You had the personal, you live in Ottawa, I believe. You say you visited the War Museum, and there, I was surprised that the, what do they call these things, expedition of 1918-19 is commemorated there. Talk about that.
Yes, we commemorate the Canadian intervention in, which is essentially the Russian Revolution. I mean, there were 12 countries that intervened in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, and Canada was among them. This hardly seems to be an event about which we should be proud, intervening in the affairs of another country. For what purpose? In this case, the purpose was to quash the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's still the principle of, are you going to launch military or a military excursion or intervention against a country which exerts no threat to Canada, which is something we did. By the way, something I learned about just recently, I didn't realize this, but Canada's participation in World War I came about not as a result of any decision that Canadians made. Canadians didn't decide to participate in World War I. The declaration of war was made by the King, and the Governor General immediately made the declaration on behalf of Canada, without any discussion about this issue with Canadians or Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something else about which we're supposed to be proud, Canada's participation in World War I. I mean, the war, anyone's participation in that is completely indefensible.
Mm-hmm. Well, that calls to mind, it's always good to remind people of the book by Jamie Swift and his co-author, his name I forget, but called The Myth of Vimy. Or the Vimy myth, pardon me, and it actually that's one of those things that you point out. This was a King's decision that actually ought to be revisited as a humiliating moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
For a people that want to live free, as it were, you would think they would announce that people would, among the grievances we would have is how many Canadians lost their lives without participating in this decision to fight the crime of crimes, a war.
Indeed, yes. And, I mean, this is kind of a holocaust against the working people of Europe and Canada, but also the colonial slaves who the European elites threw into the conflagration. I mean, the people from the colonies, the French brought their people from the colonies, the British brought the Indians and whoever they could essentially throw into the mob, this great industrial war of extermination. Mm-hmm. These people had absolutely no influence on these decisions. They were dragged into it.
Yeah, And again, this brings up another matter that you raise in your essay. You speak of the fact that you use a term, Ehrenvolk, that the system here was an Ehrenvolk system. So what is it, a master system, right? White masters.
Yeah, a democracy for a master race.
Because white Native Canadians did not have suffrage. And by the way, that's also true in the United States. They didn't get the vote until, I think it was 1960.
Yeah, and we didn't have true, Heron vote, if we want to use that, universal suffrage for white people in Canada until 1920. I mean, after the First World War. Suffrage wasn't extended to Chinese Canadians until 1947, and not to Aboriginal Canadians until 1960.
Mm-hmm. By the way, now that you say the dates, that probably the U.S., Washington and Ottawa had a meeting and said, okay, let's do this. And they couldn't do it one place unless they did it the other, I suppose. And that grew out of the expression that you use, the flag of empire. It never went anywhere without doing it by force. You say in every instance of the expansion, it was a violent deed.
Yeah, and I mean, Canada is the product of British colonialism, and we also pursued our own project of Lebensraum, for which the Nazis are known, their project of, you know, acquiring living space by expanding into Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that project, the ideal of that project, or the model for that project, was the expansion of the British colonies in the United States and in Canada into the West. Mm-hmm. In fact, if we talk about Lebensraum, I think over a 100-year period in the United States, the United States increased its territory fivefold.
Yes.
Which was a Lebensraum policy. Now, interestingly, Hitler...
Manifest destiny.
Yeah, and Hitler trying to assuage the moral qualms of some people about his Lebensraum policy. You know, we're going to move into Eastern Europe, and we're going to take the land of the Slavs, and we're going to drive the Slavs over the Urals, and we're going to also relocate the Jews into reservations. Anyway, in response to some of the moral qualms of some people, he said, well, you know, we eat Canadian wheat, and we don't think about the Red Indians. So,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, he's invoked often, but that quote isn't heard that frequently. and we're glad that it's called to our attention by Stephen Gowans, by the way, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, in your essay on Canada's sesquicentennial, What Does Humanity Have to Look Forward To, Not What Canada Represents, you also, I notice... draw on three authors that are not read here very frequently. I think it might be a cultural prejudice. Diderot, Hugo, and Barbusse. And actually, you have a very shocking line from Diderot, but a very popular one, too. I think we all learned it somewhere in our lives. You were, of course, addressing it to this thing of to the Canada's relationship to these monarchs, and you said, if you're looking for religious bigots and looking for absolute tyrants, this would be them. And you, and then you quoted Diderot. I'll let you do the line. You said maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing if this happened.
Diderot had said that humanity would never be free until the last king was strangled by the entrails of the last priest. And you might say something of the same order about people in Arab Asia perhaps not being free until the last Arab monarch is strangled by the entrails of the last Wahhabi cleric.
Yes. No, it would be a good and popular slogan, I think. And to have it actually staring us in the face, where you have killers loose in the sovereign country of Syria who attack someone based on their not being the proper, being the wrong kind of Muslim. I mean, this is a case of Muslims attacking Muslims, so-called Muslims attacking other Muslims, threatening them with death and not always threatening, carrying it out by removing their heads, and also saying, Their slogan is Christians out and Alawi to burn in hell or some such thing. I mean, whoever preaches that way, you wouldn't mind seeing them hung up for their crimes. And who are they being sponsored by but Saudi Arabia and, according to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and according to Qatar, Saudi Arabia.
Actually, both of them.
It's kind of hard to choose which of those you'd like to see go first. But it's wonderful to see the name Diderot and to see that quote. There seems to be an aversion here to some of the great French thinkers. And you also, of course, mentioned Hugo. You take a quote from Hugo about revolutions. Tell us that too is a very, very – I was very glad to see it. What was his observation?
Hugo's observation was about the French Revolution, which, of course, had nasty consequences for the aristocracy. But he also noted that it was a warm caress for the rest of humanity.
Yes. Yeah, and as you point out, the ones who care about having enough bread, having a roof over their heads, that they get more of those things after the revolution than they had before.
Yeah.
And you can understand why they're not as shocked by the revolution as the blue bloods. Again, this is Stephen Gowans. By the way, his book is Washington's Long War on Syria, and he's going to be speaking in New York at the Solidarity Center, 7 p.m., 147 West 24th Street, on the second floor, and it's handsoffsyriacoalition.net. Stephen, I want to ask, there is this, we seem to be in a situation, and I wanted to ask about Canadian foreign policy. The Chrystia Freeland, our foreign minister, very foreign, has pointed out that we can't waver on this thing of confronting Russia. We have to have a hard policy, a hard power, I think is the word she used. And as a result, she gave this speech shortly before we beefed up, or at the time we were beefing up the commitment of troops, a mighty 400 of them or 500 in the Baltics. And in the process, they invited a Latvian general. And the Globe and Mail on Wednesday, June 21st, page A5, gave him quite a lot of attention. And he raised something that I'm sure that I'd like to get your comment on. Here's what he says. He came to, and the Globe and Mail had no irony in any of this reporting. They featured this quote: "The West plays chess. There is a chessboard, and there are rules. And we are playing chess with Putin, but he is playing poker with us. He is bluffing, using hidden cards. We analyze him from our Western mindset, but he is different."
They've orientalized him.
Isn't that a good part of our problem? Is it a guy can come and talk like a fruitcake nut? I mean, about a human, another culture. I mean, the Russians have been around a while. They have produced Turgenev, Tolstoy. They won a few wars. It's a civilization, and a moron like can come and say that, and the Globe and Mail features it. Talk about this problem of, or you mentioned, used the word orientalized, or if I got the word right.
Yeah, orientalized, or drawing a distinction between civilization and barbarism, and declaring that Russia is part of this barbarian world, and we're part of this civilized world. So the barbarians think differently than us, and the barbarians are aggressive and so on. And who else belongs to the barbarian world? Well, Syria and North Korea. And interestingly, this is kind of a departure from the entire paradigm of the United Nations. I mean, the paradigm of the United Nations is that countries are equal. All countries are equal. And it's a regression to the League of Nations. And the League of Nations paradigm was that there are some countries that were part of civilization, and there are other countries that were part of the barbarian world, and it was incumbent upon those within the civilized world to guide the barbarians and to exercise a dictatorship.
It's a mission.
Barbarians, yes. And so we seem to have arrived at that place now where essentially we have an international dictatorship of the United States supported by countries like Canada and France and Britain and some countries that are opposed to that dictatorship, which you could argue are really truly democratic countries because they reject this despotism. One of them is Russia. There's China. There's Syria. There's Iran. And there are a few others that refuse to submit to the international dictatorship. And those countries are then, described as part of the barbarian world. They yeah. think differently. They're yeah. aggressive.
Yeah. By the way, that was General Groby, a former commander of the Latvian National Armed Forces. He doesn't seem to know that Iranians, Persians invented chess. And the Americans invented poker, didn't they? Or I don't know who started poker. But this is a seriously messed up man. But Chrystia Freeland, whose favorite country is Ukraine, when she talks about the Ukraine, she always speaks of those of the Western Ukraine have the advanced ideas. And the ones on the other side of the river are the barbarians, right?
Yes. I mean, it turned everything on its head. Also, the entire idea that the United States, or not the United States, that Russia is aggressive and belligerent in this case when we move NATO forces right up to the Russian borders is simply absurd.
Yes. In his interview, this Latvian pointed out that he says, well, we have a couple of thousand troops on the border of Russia, but they've got more on the other side. That would make sense that they are Russia on the other side. but anyway, I call attention to it, and because it seems to me so pertinent to your writing, is that we have entered this world where, as we started off this interview talking about, in the case of Syria, we believe the least likely thing that they would be choosing to use chemical weapons when they're doing so well, and then it. Then they, in the case of talking about their attitude towards the East and towards people of, let's say specifically Russians, that somehow their behavior is barbaric when we're the ones running the armies up to their border. And the solution, I like your point, let's admit, I mean, the United Nations exists because of World War II and the resorting out of humanity, right? Which brings us to Henri Barbusse. Mr. Barbusse was a brilliant writer. When he died, there were tens of thousands of people followed his coffin through the streets, and they put each of his books on a pillow. They had people from the Literary Society of France carrying each of his books on a pillow behind him. We hardly know his name. Tell us what Mr. Barbusse had to say.
Well, one of the interesting ideas I thought that he had raised, it probably wasn't interesting or so unusual at a certain time, but today it seems unusual. I mean, he was interested in countries who are carrying out a project of making life better for humanity. So he asked the question, what does humanity have to look forward to? And we can ask, is there any country that or any country's government that is engaged in a project of creating conditions in which humanity has something to look forward to. Perhaps you could make the argument that the Chinese government is doing that for the Chinese. Mm-hmm. But if we ask that question and then apply it to the idea of Canada, I mean, what is Canada doing that contributes to creating something that humanity can look forward to? And as I thought about this, you know, I thought about a Canada that embraced the commitments of Norman Bethune, the famous Canadian, well-known, notable mm-hmm. Canadian. I'm not sure how famous he is. But he was the skilled and innovative surgeon who, from Montreal, I believe, but I originally from Gravenhurst.
Gravenhurst.
Who I guess is best known for fighting in the Spanish Civil War and then for fighting in the Second Sino-Japanese War. But, I mean, a Canada that embraced the commitments of Norman Bethune, I mean, who fought fascism in Spain, who helped overcome feudalism and colonialism in China, and who also pioneered the fight for universal health care in Canada. I mean, that would provide a model for a world that humanity could look forward to. Mm-hmm. In contrast to a Canada that hammers out arms deals with medieval tyrannies and whose pilots in Libya flew bombing missions for Al-Qaeda by the admission of Canadian pilots.
Yes. Yes, you have a great quote. I urge people to read this article, by the way, gowans.wordpress.com, where they did say, we are Al-Qaeda's Air Force. And of course, as you point out, they said it as a joke, except that it was true.
And except an Ottawa citizen reporter had access to Canadian military intelligence files that showed that the Canadian military intelligence knew that the uprising was engineered or carried out by Al-Qaeda forces or Al-Qaeda-aligned forces. They told Harper, who was prime minister at the time, and of course he denied this publicly, but it was certainly the case that the Canadian military knew exactly what was going on. Which is why, although they said they quipped that they were Al-Qaeda's Air Force, they must have known, indeed, they were Al-Qaeda's Air Force.
Yeah, we kind of put a burden on some of the people who carry out these terrible deeds in that they're supposed to keep a straight face and pretend they don't know what they're doing. Well, I'm very glad you invoked the name Norman Bethune. I absolutely agree. I think it provides a direction. And Stephen, I guess you must be looking forward to going to New York. That's going to be quite an occasion. July 14.
Yes, and I'll also be in New Haven, Connecticut, and Rochester, New York as well.
Okay. But can people get your – go to gowans.wordpress.com? Is that where they would find where you're going to be?
Yes, exactly.
Well, very good. Well, Stephen, thanks again for being with us, and great sight, what's left, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Gowans, thank you.